Golden Spiral Media presents The Blacklist Exposed.
Hey, yo, special agents, welcome back to our first of our special holiday bonus editions here on The Blacklist Exposed. I am Agent Troy Heinrichs.
And I am Agent Aaron Peterson, and I am very excited to share with all of you our interview with James Spader's boss, John Bokenkamp. It was recorded on December 5th, 2015. Show notes and other intel for this episode of The Blacklist Exposed can be found at theblacklistexposed.com.
Before we get rolling with the special episode and our conversation with the creator himself, a quick note to stick around because, again, at the end of the episode, we have two points of business for you. Number one, the winner of our Trick or Treat and Thanks contest. So you want to be around for the drawing. Again, the winner will get a copy of Season 1 and Season 2 in time for the holidays, shipped to your house for The Blacklist. And then second, we have our announcement of who next week's special cast member that is going to be stopping by the podcast. So you don't want to miss who that's going to be. So stay locked in.
All right. Now, as promised, we are here to talk to John Bokenkamp. None of you care about us at this point. All you care about is hearing from the man that created The Blacklist itself. Now, I think it's important that we elaborate in terms of what John Bokenkamp's role is. He runs the show. He is, Jane, I said it at the beginning, but he's basically the boss. So he's the guy that's basically responsible for all the creative decisions that are going on, networks aside, at the show. And it's very important that you know that when we're talking to him, because he has insight into every single aspect of The Blacklist.
Yep, which buttons are on the shirt, what the color is, everything. That minutia of a detail. So you want to keep your ears open, because the words he chooses just may be clues. You never know.
God. Troy is totally doing that just to make you freak out and be like, rewind!
That 30-second skip button on your podcast player, that's what that's for.
Yes, yes. We had a very extensive interview with him. It went long. We would apologize, but we're not sorry. We really appreciate the time that he spent with us. It was a great interview. It's really exciting. He goes into detail on just about every facet of the show, and I loved it. I don't know about you, Trey.
I think it was absolutely fantastic. We get to hear a little bit about how he got to go to the Hollywood all the way from Nebraska and making that jump because he started out in film going back to TV. That's always interesting to hear about. But he really gets into some of his favorite blacklisters, some of his favorite episodes, and he even settles some classic questions I think that a lot of us have had over the years. One of them might even be around, is Samar and Aram actually in a relationship? We actually tackle that one for you.
Yeah, and he also, Troy's stupid mother theory comes up because it can't die. And I was really hoping he would kill it. Not nope. Saying if he does or not, but Troy doesn't think so.
Nope. It's really, good. It's a good theory.
I honestly would have sent him money if he just would have said no. No. But he did not. Oh, well.
You're going to send $75,000 so we can get the one song you want.
That's very expensive. All right. I think you've heard us talk enough. We'll be come back to the back half. That's where you're going to hear us a little bit more. Let's get into the interview with Mr. John Bokenkamp.
Hi, John.
Yes.
Hey, it's Troy. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing fabulous. And thanks so much for doing this. And Aaron's on as well.
I am Aaron. Nice to meet you, sir.
Nice to meet you. So are we just chit-chat? I listen to many of the podcasts. It just seems very casual, right? I mean, I listened to as much as I could stand of Dan Knopf, and I was like, okay, that is Dan Knopf. So I get, but it seems quite casual, right?
Yes, yes. Very, very casual. Just keep it PG-13, so to speak, just because. Just like TV. TV swearing. There you go. So if you want to say something, just keep it around the TV level. You're all good.
Look, I love that you guys are supporting the show and talking about the show and speaking about it so articulately. And I'm like, wow. And then I saw that you connected with Dan, and I'm like, how cool. I'd love to chat with you. So whatever, I mean, quite honestly, whatever I can do to, what's good for you guys is good for me, and hopefully vice versa. And I'm just happy to, you know, talk about the show or writing in general or TV or movies or any of that stuff. And to the extent that I can be interesting, I'm happy to chat.
That's exactly how we feel about it too, John, is that it's we're an extension of you guys. So if we're ever doing anything that you guys hate, just say, hey, stop talking about that.
You're yeah, no, show. It's all good. I'm trying to be better about social media stuff. And I've got one of the things I'm thinking about doing is trying to get like some kind of site where I could be posting either new music and stuff that's going on with the show and backstage or sort of behind the scenes photos and stuff. And I'm like, it'd be great. Post the podcast when you guys do it and stuff and you know, try to help get a reach and get Megan talking about it and that kind of stuff. And, you know, so anyway, all for it. But yeah, I'll let you guys drive the conversation and I'll just try to make sense.
Why don't we start with the beginning? Actually, it's funny because you actually grew up in a town that I have friends in over in Kearney, Nebraska.
You're kidding me.
Yes, actually, one of my friends helped you with the World Theater renovation.
Oh, get out of town. Who do you know in Kearney?
So it's the Arrowoods, Jamie LeGates.
Yeah.
Yep, Mr. Arrowood teaches down the road at the neighboring town. He said he didn't have the privilege of teaching you because he was in the other town.
I don't
know
that would have been much of a privilege, but that is very, very small world. That is crazy. Yeah, I am from Kearney, Nebraska, which is the middle of – its significance is that it has no significance. You know, it's a very small town, and that's what I love about it. And my wife and I live there, you know, and it's just – it's great. And the way that we know each other there is that I know your friends there is through the World Theater. That is an old movie theater where I grew up going to movies. I saw, well, at least Rocky III, Empire Strikes Back, you know, a lot of great movies there when I was a kid. And it's where I kind of decided I wanted to be – a movie maker. I don't know if I thought I was going to be an actor or what I thought it was going to be, but I fell in love with movies there. And then when I moved back, the theater had closed. And so I put together a nonprofit organization and we reopened the theater and we show, you know, indie art house movies. It's an old 1927 theater and it's super cool. It's all volunteer run and, you know, the movies are $5 a piece and the soda and popcorn are all like $1, $2, and $3 and nobody's getting screwed at the concession stand. And it's a great environment. So that is super cool to know that there's actually a connection there. I'm meeting people through the World Theater. That's pretty cool.
And I'm sure because you have connections, you can screen a couple of the previews and a little bit of the season finales and have little viewing parties there for the hometown.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we do a screening every week when the show airs. We do a sort of a pre-screening. The episodes we do them the same day, but people who come to the theater, we don't charge anything. And we run Sony sends a drive, which basically has the episode on it. And so, you know, people show up, we watch it without commercials, and then I FaceTime in and we do a little Q&A and we talk about the episode and what worked and what didn't and all the drama behind the scenes and stuff. And it's super cool.
You do that every week?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, as much as I can. There's sometimes where schedules make it a little tough, but yeah,
that's great.
It's a way to stay connected with home and it's a great way to kind of help make money for the theater. And it's fun to see, you know, you work so hard on each episode that it's like birthing it, you know? And so to have a moment that's, you know, people are energized from seeing the episode and wanting to talk about it. You know, we think about it and work on it for so long. It's nice to finally be able to talk about it and say, okay, that's the thing we've been excited to do for the past 3 months. What did you guys think? Mm-hmm. You know? So, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
That's very cool. I had no idea about that. That's very cool.
Yeah.
So how'd you finally get to Hollywood? What made you leave home and finally get to Hollywood? How'd you do it?
I wanted to be Luke Skywalker when I was young. I guess I came out here to film school. I went to USC and started sort of out of film school. I was waiting tables and valet parking cars at Universal Studios and working during the days to be a writer because I wanted to direct, and I realized fairly early that nobody was going to hire me to direct the next big blockbuster because there were a ton of people who wanted to do that. And mm-hmm. that a way that I could kind of control things for myself was to create new material. And if I had a script that people liked, then I could have some, you know, sense of control. Or so I thought. And I sort of fell into writing. I wrote my first script took 3 years to write. And I eventually directed it as, you know, a little indie movie. But it got me sort of, you know, got me my first rewrite job, and one job sort of got the next. And then it was at a time in probably 95 or 6 where, you know, indie movies were happening and there was a lot of work, you know, there was a lot of stuff happening and there were rewrite assignments and stuff. And more recently, all that stuff has dried up in features and kind of shifted to TV. But yeah, I came out to be Luke Skywalker and I was lucky enough to get hired to write scripts.
Wow. But you didn't have a writing partner, though. I remember reading in an interview that you said that you like to actually pitch the ideas to your wife.
I do, yeah. I don't know that she likes that, but I do. You know, we have very different sensibilities, and so it's kind of fun to
you know, the kinds of movies that I like and write are the kinds of things that she would probably never go to. So she's very honest about it and can point out what doesn't work. I typically am kind of a plot guy. I sort of see a picture or an image, or there's some twist that I'm working toward in a story. And she's all about character and the soap and the drama and all of that, which doesn't come naturally to me. So she's good at sort of being a sounding board. And, you know, that was as a feature writer. And since I've started working in TV, it's very different. I've never had the experience of being around other people and other writers. And, you know, I'm the guy who typically is sitting in a room alone all day in my underwear in front of a computer trying to write a script. And I'm not used to having other people to talk to. So my wife didn't have much of a choice other than to talk to me about it. But yeah, she's a great sounding board.
I got to admit, I've talked to a lot of creative types in Hollywood, and you are way more grounded than most people that I've talked to.
Oh, just wait. I'm going to become such a prick and such a egomaniac. Just wait. Thank you for saying so. You know what? I'll tell you, a funny thing is I'm old enough, I feel like, that I saw some ups with feature stuff that I did, and I had the moments where I could get hired, and then I had the moments where I couldn't get hired. And my wife and I decided that we wanted to go home and raise our kids in Nebraska and sort of start over. And I, you know, and the Blacklist happened after that. And it was after like 2008 and the financial meltdown, and there was a Writers Guild strike, and I technically couldn't work even if I could get hired, and it was hard, you know. And then so when the show happened and I actually got hired to write a script, I was just so excited to do that because I know how hard it is to get in that position. And then now, you know, if the show doesn't work or if it all ends tomorrow, I gotta go home. And so I think that helped. I if the show had happened 15 years ago, I would probably be a complete egomaniac and a disaster. I still might be. In time.
It could happen.
Believe me, anything could happen.
You've done a lot in film. You did Taking Lives. You did a couple Halle Berry thrillers, actually. You did Perfect Stranger and The Call, which I think is a really good movie, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was actually my buddy Rich DeVideo, who really wrote that, was very generous. We had sold a TV idea, which was, it was basically, it was that movie. We had sold an idea for a TV show, which would be a 911 operator. It's like Grey's Anatomy, but in a 911 facility. And it didn't work. And ultimately, you know, I think it was ABC was like, yeah, not really interested. And Rich took that idea and was like, you know what? I'm going to go. I think it'd be a great movie. And so he went out and did that. I really had helped him develop some of the story ideas that were in there early on, but he's really the guy that went out and wrote the movie, and his wife, Nicole, they really did the work on that one. But it's a fun movie. And they're trying to do a second one, I think.
Really? Yeah. It definitely was a fun movie. I really liked that movie. I was pleasantly surprised.
It was a good ride. Yeah, it was a good ride. It was just one of those fast sort of, you didn't have to think too much. It was just jump on and get your popcorn and kind of check out. It was fun.
So when you're going from what for you is the difference? You're working on movies. It's completely different than television. I assume television affords you the ability to be able to expand on the story somewhat, but there's got to be perks to film too. So what for you is the pluses and minuses to each, I guess?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that they're actually making TV shows and they're not making movies. I mean, that it's just so hard to get a movie made. And I'm not really interested in the movies, most of the movies that get made. I mean, I love the sort of smart, you know, I'm looking at my desk now. I got like screeners for Legend and Trumbo and Beast of No Nation. Like those are interesting to me, but I know those are passion projects, and a studio or a network is not exactly, our studio is not exactly like, you know, killing themselves to go make an art movie. I think they're very difficult. And the other stuff is sort of big explosions, and I'm not a big comic book guy. To me, it was really about, quite honestly, I like Breaking Bad, and I was like, wow, it'd be great to do something like that. Oh, it'd be fun to tell a story about, you know, a TV show, because it was so character driven. And I don't know, I was just blown away by that. It was a movie every week. And I thought, wow, maybe I should try that, you know, because I can't get hired to write a movie. So why don't I write a TV show? But it is a different process, I think, you know, in a feature. And even that, one of the things that helps me in the show is that I work backwards. I know what the twist is at the end or what the hook is. And then I work backwards from that. It's very difficult for me to sort of just start and go, how about an episode or a movie about whatever? Pick a, you choose. It just, I don't know where it goes, you know, and it becomes meandering. And with a feature, it's very much like a math problem to me. I've written mostly thrillers and mysteries and that sort of stuff, which I love. And then with TV, it feels like there's a little more, there's more space, you know, there's more room to expand the sort of serialized element of the story, the character drama. And to me, it's a little like if you're going to take a road trip and you look at the map and you go, okay, I want to get from LA to New York and I'm going to stop in these 12 cities on the way. And then you throw away the map and you go, well, I'm kind of feeling my way there. I know where we're going to end up here. I know where we're going to end up in, you know, we're going to stop in Kansas City. We're going to stop in Chicago, but we don't quite know how we're going to get from those two towns. And you're sort of making it up as you go, but you have signposts along the way. And it's very different than a feature to me. A feature is such limited time and real estate. Different animals, I think.
Well, you talk about the hook and knowing where you're going to be at the end. So you write this pilot, the script for The Blacklist, and then you have Sony comes in and NBC comes in and then John Eisendrath comes on with you. You know, is the show still the hook originally what you thought, or has it kind of adjusted as all these other influencers have come into the picture?
Yeah, I mean, what the show is to me and where it's going is still the same and yet different in ways. I mean, we've found characters along the way that are fun that we didn't know about. We've made detours in the storytelling, but the mythology and the ultimate end game of the series is the same thing that, and I remember when it clicked what it was and when we landed on what we wanted to do. I remember being at home and being on the phone with Eisendrath and saying, could we do that? Would that work? And we kind of got laughing about it and we were so excited. And it's been one of the things that makes the show very difficult to write is that we try so desperately to be true to the mythology, and we've got documents and writer's assistants and people in the room who are just, every time we talk about the past, we go, okay, wait, are we breaking the mythology? And so it makes it difficult, but you know, you discover fun things along the way. Glenn was somebody that was like,
I love Glenn.
Glenn's great, right? And Clark Middleton's great. And I wanted to call a character Jellybean Carter. I don't even know where that came from or why I thought that was funny. And I thought Jellybean Carter would be a great character. And then we saw Clark Middleton was sent to us as an actor that our casting people said, you should just be aware of this guy. And it's like, okay, I want to write something for him. And then we're like, where is he going to fit in? And you know, so stuff like that was never there in the beginning. It wasn't like in season two, we're going to meet Jellybean Carter. You sort of find that along the way. And that's part of the joy of it that, again, in a feature, you don't get the opportunity to do, at least the way I write a feature. You know, this is a very different sort of process.
Now, when you pitch it to the network, do they, because of so many serialized shows these days, do they say, we got to know that you have an ending in mind before you start the show? Do they require that you elaborate on it somewhat, or do they let you keep that close to the vest? I mean, how does that work in terms of the true mythology?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, look, I've only had this experience, so I don't know how it is with others. I think if you went in and said, you know, they say you do a Bible and sort of come up with, here's where the show's going. You know, if we went in and said, first off, I think if I went in and said, here's where we're going to end, this is what the show is, I think they'd say, you're nuts and we're not going to do that. I also think that they would probably say, well, that'll probably change. And I think they would think you're full of it, you know, because it has to change and it has to evolve as you're writing and you find, you know, it's continually changing shape. You know, I remember when the only other thing I had written in television was I wrote a script that Sony bought, and I went out with Chris Carter, who did the X-Files, and we tried to sell it, and it didn't happen. And I remember when we went in, specifically, I remember the meeting we took to NBC, and Chris had worked with Bob Greenblatt on the X-Files, and there was Fox, and he had been there at the time. There was like a connection, so it was a very friendly room, and Bob Greenblatt is the president of NBC. And so we went in, and I remember before the meeting, I had this like 5-page document because I had been told so many times they're going to want to know where the show's going and how it's, who all the characters are and how they weave together. And Chris was like, yeah, we're not talking about any of that. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? He's like, we're just going to tell them it's great and it's going to be mysterious and you're going to love it. And I'm like, how are we going to do that? And of course we didn't sell it, but I like the philosophy. I think is right that
ultimately, you have to be open to a million different versions of how it goes. And even the story that I have in mind could dramatically change by the time we get to the end. But so all of that is a long-winded way of saying I had an idea, more specifics really about the characters and what the show would look and feel like. They weren't really worried about the serialization. That wasn't really much of a conversation. It's funny, the way the show has developed and what it is and how much is serialized and how much is standalone has kind of found its way. I can say it was planned and we knew we were going to do a Case of the Week show, but we didn't really know the component. You know, people would ask and say, how much is serialized? How much is standalone? And you kind of go, well, I don't know. We'll write the script and kind of see how it feels. And we still do that.
I think you have to, especially when you have 22 episodes. I mean, that's a heavy burden these days.
Well, that's right. Yeah. And you look at a script or you look at the break of a story and you go, eh, like the Case of the Week ultimately is not, nobody remembers that. I mean, you remember a good character, you know, you remember the Stewmaker or Milton Bobbitt, or you remember a Gina Zanatakos, or you remember maybe the vibe and the shape and the feel of a character, but ultimately, I'm super not interested, and I don't really think anybody here is interested in, well, there was a fingerprint on the glass. Wait, if we enlarge that fingerprint and run it through the VICAP system, we might, ugh, who cares? Like, I'm just not interested in that. So when we look at the stories, oftentimes we go, ugh, there's not enough red here. There's not enough emotional stuff. There's not enough serialization, or there's too much, you know? And so it is a constant balance of that, trying to strike that balance. And then it's funny listening to you guys talk about it saying, well, this one felt like the case was interesting, but it felt a little like a filler. And I go, oh, my God, I'm neurotic. A filler, what does that mean? I thought this one was like, I hope it wasn't a filler, you know. And it's so hard to tell. And I read comments and stuff and go, wait, did people think we were too – was that too much of a story? Do we need more mythology revealed? It's very difficult to tell. That's very hard.
Man, I always feel bad about that. I'll be honest with you, because I love creative mentalities. And I realize that nobody, even Uwe Boll, I don't think set out to make some of the worst movies of all time. Mm. You know, I think when you're doing that, I think people, they're trying to make something good. So it's always hard to talk about it if it doesn't always gel with you or whatever. And I think we try to be fair about that, but that's
funny. Oh, please, but that's the fun of what you guys do, is that the television is a very interactive process, you know? I mean, whereas a movie, you're sitting with a bunch of people. I feel like TV, it happens so fast, and there's, I don't know if they're called chat rooms, I don't know what they are anymore, but there's like blogs and comment sections articles and what you guys are doing, and so it's much more immediate, I feel like. And I love hearing that. I love hearing how things are. For every time there's like, well, was that a filler episode? Or did that, I didn't like that character. I didn't expect that turn. There's also, it's so fun to hear people talk about and guess what's happening and what is the connection here or what's going to happen. That you're like seeing people try to fill in the blanks. That's clearly more fun, you know? But it's great to sort of interact in a weird social media sort of way. Never experienced anything like that before.
Yeah, and I hope that we actually bridge that gap for the fans, because I know a lot of fans are like, oh, immediate gratification, pay it off now. And it's like, we're trying to figure out, you know, guys, well, it's a filler because it's 22 episodes because the network has a schedule. This isn't because the writers wanted to just, you know, take a day off or something.
Well, that's right. By the way, I'm super not defensive about the filler. I'm sure, you know, 22 episodes, you're like, look, some are going to be better than others. Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting. I've heard you guys say that you think we pay things off very quickly, which I guess we do. And, you know, the show from the beginning was like, I'm not very patient with, I like a mystery and I like a bigger question, but I get impatient. You know, the instinct in our writer's room is always to kind of slide stuff up. Oftentimes we'll have, actually, I remember we had the episode where Red murdered Sam Milhone, Liz's adoptive father. And that was going to be the end of the episode. It's like, wow, that'll be such a great, oh my God, he did that at the end of the episode. And I remember in the room, Eisendrath was like, yeah, I feel like we need that in Act 3. And I'm like, Act 3? What are you talking about? How could we got to save that as a great twist, you know, in the movie, that'd be the hook. And at the end of the movie, and we moved it up. And you're constantly moving up story and trying to gauge how fast to burn through story and how much to slow it down. And you know, be patient because you want it to last for a while, you know, and it's hard. It's a very delicate balance. Sometimes we do it better than others. And
you know, we're constantly trying to find that balance.
Well, that episode was awesome because when you go back, we just did the 44 episode rewatch to get ready for season 3.
Oh my God.
Troy did a 44 episode. I did not. Good memory. I'm good.
44.
It was great. It was glorious.
Love that.
But then you go back and you watch that sequence right in the last act when Red sits down at the table with Tom and you're like, now I know the answer that these guys have been working together way before the show started. And
right.
You're like, what clues are in that scene that you missed the first time? Body language, where they look, who they talk to. And I think it's just really interesting to watch it the second time through because there's so much you just pick up on when you know the answer versus when you didn't. And it just increases the enjoyment tenfold.
Well, that's right. And that's one of the fun things. And also, again, the thing that's very difficult is some of that stuff is completely premeditated. Some of it we're reverse engineering to try to figure out, okay, wait, could we actually do that? Would that make sense with what we did, you know, 15 episodes ago? And so that's part of the puzzle. You know, I actually hate puzzles, but I love a good puzzle, you know, and a good mystery. And so it is a little like a math problem going, okay, will this line up with the mythology of what we said 20 episodes ago? We did that today. We have a pending actor availability. We have a fun character that we're going to bring back from the first season that we were like, okay, we think this will work, but we just got to, you know, make sure that all those looks and all those glances and all those things made sense, you know, and this is one of those that we sort of found along the way and that wasn't premeditated from the beginning. It could be a lot of fun.
Well, speaking of story, while you're bringing that up, and as things progress and they evolve and everything, did Daniel tell you about Troy's nutty Red is Liz's mom's theory? Did you?
Oh, I heard about this. Yes,
because I'm watching the finale, the fall finale, and there's a moment, and I'm just asking you because I had to ask, and Troy's like,
well, you know, I'm not going to confirm nor deny.
No. I actually don't. I am unlike most fans of this show. I don't want to know. I actually want to see it pay off.
No. Okay, cool.
My question is, in the fall finale, there's actually a moment where, was it Jilly? Jilly, right?
Yep, Jilly.
Is basically kind of feeling Red up. Is that like a nod to that theory? Because it almost felt like one.
You know what? That was not a nod to that theory.
Okay.
However, I do believe that theory is one of many that sort of stands up. You know, I mean, if you play the logic is, you know, one of the things we look at is what are we saying no to? You know, there are very few things where it's like, okay, let's definitively say this is an answer because that's hard. You know, very early on we said there's sort of this idea that Red doesn't really ever lie to Liz. He tells partial truths, but he doesn't flat out lie. And I'm telling you, that can be a pain in the room where we're like, oh my God, because he's constantly withholding information. That is one of those that you're, God knows what, when we wrap it all up. I would love if that's actually it and we play this back, how amazing would that be? I mean, that would be a great prediction.
And it makes Troy very happy.
That's, you know, that's it. I think that's what's so fun about the show is that there's different ways you can look at it and different ways we can approach it. But I do agree with you that I don't think, and Spader has said this, he's like, I don't think people want to know. You know, we were at Comic-Con. They're like, somebody said, what is the end? Is he your father? You know, and he's like, you don't want to know. I'm like, really? And I think he might be right about that. You know, that's part of the mystery.
Well, once you know, there's nothing to talk about. Really?
Right, you're done. Right? The story's over.
Absolutely.
That is true. That is absolutely true.
Yeah, you want it to live on forever, like the like Sopranos. When it ends, and it's like, people talk about it to this day still, and that's what you want. You want that legacy to go on forever.
Never saw it. I'm sure it was a great show. I heard other people watched it, and it was fantastic.
It was
but
all right.
I missed it. I was in a weird bubble of missing a lot of great shows. But you're right. There's fun in the guessing game and in the anticipation of resolution, you know? And that's one of the things that we have a lot of fun with is setting up and unraveling secrets. From day one, that was something that we thought would be fun. It's just everyone has a secret, and nobody's who they appear to be on the surface. And, you know, Red saying in the pilot, everything I tell you, I'm a criminal, you know, everything about me is a lie. And that has sort of woven its way into the fabric of what the show is.
Well, going back to the two leads of this show, when it comes to Red and Liz, how did you, when you were casting and everything, you cast Megan Boone, you cast James Spader, how has casting those two actors led to the story we have now? Like, how has that casting helped evolve the storyline? Or change what your original plans were, maybe? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. Well, you know, it's interesting. We cast Megan first, and we met with her, and she, it's, you know, she had this great sort of pixie cut and this great energy, and she was very, I remember in the room when she was auditioning, she started doing whatever the scene was and then stopped and did it again and stopped and started again. I'm like, what is she doing? She was like, is this some weird interpretation of it? And then I realized, oh, she's just maybe nervous and didn't like it and was starting over. And I was like, how weird to be that sort of like open about not getting it right yet and trying. She just had a great spirit in the room. And so we cast her, and then we were like, okay, we got to get red. We got to figure out who that is. And we had gone out to a number of people, and you know, the studio and the network were excited and taking big shots of people that were just either wrong or not realistic, you know, in a weird way. And we were trying to figure out, we couldn't find somebody. We legitimately, I mean, we pushed 3 days, and we almost didn't shoot and became a mid-season show because we couldn't find an actor. And I remember having a long conversation with James' agent and him pitching James, and I didn't quite get it. I knew of Spader's work, and I thought he was great, but he wasn't really what I originally saw. You know, I'm picturing him again. He was coming off The Office, and he had this crazy hair, and he was sort of on that show with Robert California and Lincoln. He was kind of this eccentric, weird character, and didn't fit with what I had in my mind. And then I talked to him, and John Eisendrath and I and Spader had like a 2.5 hour conversation about the character and who he was and how he would play it and what he would look like. And the way he was inside of it was just like, wow, this guy gets it, you know? And then when we shot the pilot, I remember we were shooting that scene in the orange box. There's a close up of him where he's sort of just a little facial thing that he does. And I was like, wow, this guy is good. And he has a weird sense of humor that influences the show in ways that I didn't expect. And I think that him being a guy who has done this forever and Megan being relatively new when we started sort of lended itself to a show about an experienced criminal and somebody who was brand new, at least in the first season or two. You know, you kind of see that as Megan. I think we've watched Megan sort of grow into her own, and I think she's become better, and I think she's more natural, and not that she wasn't before, but I think that she's, at a certain point, I feel like you start writing for the actor and the character and the actor kind of become the same, you know, in a weird way. I wouldn't say it's influenced what the show is, but it certainly influences the voice and the way that we write. I think that's true for all the characters, whether it's Amir, who plays Aram, or Diego, who plays Wrestler, or Mojan, like all the actors sort of have a hear them saying the words when you're writing them, and you go, yeah, he's not going to say that, or she would say that in a different way. So again, that's interesting. I've never had that experience.
Well, that was kind of the big argument that Aaron and I had about Mojan and the whole incident with the episode that she was in there towards the end of the season, the Zalbin uh-huh. Hassan. And I was like, oh, you know, I really wish that, you know, she had this whole episode earlier in the show where she thought right. She kills the guy who killed her brother. And now here, her brother is the one that actually killed her brother in the flesh. And she has just that small moment. And I'm like, gosh, I wanted that to be so much bigger because she was betrayed.
You wanted that to be a two-parter, right? Yeah, I totally. Feel like I remember you thinking that was a two-parter.
Absolutely.
It's funny. Maybe it could have been. Again, the mapping out, you know, 22, and you look at where the breaks are. You go, well, we're off in you know, after episode 8, and then we're off after episode 18. You kind of start seeing the cliffhangers and where they come. And so that sort of dictates that. But that's interesting. And, you know, at the same time, you don't know when you're breaking it and committing to, well, this will be episode 7. I think the Onslow Garrick episode was the first one where we were like, maybe this is 2 episodes, you know. And originally we thought it was 1 and it sort of grew. And it's hard to tell. That's hard to tell. But I agree. I mean, that story, and maybe that means that story's not done. Maybe we can go back to that a little more in some way and mine that.
Yeah, because she's still mourning that loss, especially now that she's obviously lost her job at the post office, and she's lost her trust and faith in Aram because she lied to him. So there's just a lot of emotion. It'll be interesting to see what she does when we come back in January.
Oh, she's off the show now. She's no longer part of the team. She was fired. I'm joking.
I highly doubt that.
She's distraught.
I'm sure we will find some way to weave Samar back in.
I got to tell you, there's always things that happen in the show, and because we do the podcast, obviously people will reach out to us and be like, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? But when her and Russ are hooked up, man, people would not leave us alone about. I can't
thumbs
believe
up, it. Thumbs down.
I loved it. People didn't. They were kind of split.
People hated it. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually wrote just to do a friend who runs a website, a Blacklist website. I wrote an article on it, and it got people were crazy over that. I'm like, it's just a TV show. They're not real people. But people, well, man, they take them to heart. They take them to heart.
Well, I'll tell you what. There is a small story. Well, I don't even know if it's a story or just maybe a philosophy or a nugget behind that. That, well, I don't know. We'll see where it goes, but because it's become interesting. It's like them, Liz and Red being on the run. We didn't really know at the beginning of the season how long we would want to keep them on the run. Would it be a full season? Would it be an episode? And you kind of feel it out. But with Samar and Wrestler, I don't know that he's the right guy. You know, and for the sake of drama, because I think there's a triangle there, right? There's Aram, there's Wrestler, there's Samar. I mean, that's a potential triangle.
Well, there's actually like two triangles because you've got Liz over here too, and you know that
that's
he has.
True. Yeah. Well, that's true. But I do think that it is much more interesting for her to potentially go to bed with the wrong guy and see what happens from that and where that goes and the fallout from that. Versus going to bed with who feels like the right guy, which clearly would have been Aram. I don't know where that story would have gone. They probably would have gone and had dinner, you know? I don't know. Like, well, I don't know what the next episode would be. But after episode 7, where they did sleep together, in the very next one, that was a fun story for us where Aram is juggling with, do I do the right thing or not? Mm-hmm. I know a secret about her and I'm pissed, but do I... you know what I mean? Like, and Samar is upset with him and trying and lying to him. And so that, quite honestly, was just more fertile ground for storytelling and conflict and drama. Who knows where it goes? That's interesting. I'm always blown away by how passionate I get. Like how either people are for either Red and Liz are father and daughter, or they're going to bed together. Or Samar and Aram, or Wrestler and Liz. I mean, the sort of shipping, which is a word I'd never heard of, is fascinating.
Yeah, it happens a lot.
Yeah.
So go there.
It's wild.
Yeah, go there with the episode at the end of episode 2. It's like you have talking about captaining a ship in a shipping container on a ship. I mean, was that clearly like a nod out to the shippers?
No, well, see, I should say yes. Of course it was. No, not at all. It was not. But we do follow it. You know, we have in the writer's room, one of our assistants here goes on the web every day and finds the strangest thing they can find about the Blacklist. And it gets pretty weird. I mean, there's like Mr. Cattington's blog, you know, Red's cat that was in his secret apartment has a blog, or some of the fan fiction stuff, some of the drawings. It is so cool. I mean, it's just so weird and so cool. I love that.
Well, the people are still so attached to Hudson, even though the original Hudson we know passed away, and then you had to get a new Hudson for the show.
The original, we saw dailies, and I was like, what the hell happened to Hudson? He's like, that's not even the same. That's not even the same kind of dog. I mean, they're the same color. But they have nothing. I mean, it has nothing. I think, yeah, Hudson died, and they got a new Hudson. And you may keep your eyes open for a Hudson 3.0. I think Hudson might be like Kenny on South Park. Like, he just keeps appearing, and he's different every time.
That would be fantastic.
Oh, that's a great segue, then, because
Hudson turns into a big poodle.
Tom's wearing the hoodie, and Liz is wearing the hoodie, so we need to put Hudson in a hoodie.
Yeah, I like the hoodie. That'd be great.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
How do the actors feel? I mean, I assume when they're on the street, I'm a real behind the scenes guy. So every time I'm watching, I'm like, they're actors. You know, I never get that where I think they're people. But I know a lot of people, they really are passionate about the show, and they do see them as the characters they play. So do they go on the street? Like, is Jane Spader at the gas station and somebody's like, hey, are you Red? And they think he's a master criminal or something similar with Liz, or they get mad about a love triangle. They get mad at Ryan because, you know, he's a turncoat.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I've talked to Ryan where he's been in, I can't remember where he was, Italy or something. And, you know, the bartender at some beach hotel was like, Tom Keen, you're Tom Keen, you know, or Clark Middleton, who plays Glenn, said we were emailing back and forth. And he said, people will shout lines to him on the freeway. And I was like, what? I emailed him back. I'm like, what lines? What are, Glenn has specific lines. And he did. He wrote me back. And he's like, these lines. I'm like, well, I guess that's true. They want to know, are the turtles okay? You know, Glenn had to go home and feed the turtles. And so I do think that, yeah, the guys, again, that's something I'm so far removed from. We're in LA and we shoot in New York. So, you know, with the writer's room here, there is a bit of a weird disconnect. But, you know, when I go to set and we go to dinner or something, it's always weird to me to be like the guy walking in behind Megan or Amir or Spader. And people are like, wait, that's the guy from the show. And I'm like, oh my God, how weird. They're being recognized. I'd be so paranoid if I were an actor on a TV show or a movie. My God, a weird existence.
How does that work? You're a big fan of Breaking Bad. Vince Gilligan has talked numerous times about how they worked in L.A. and the set was in New Mexico. If you guys are in New York, I mean, how does that communication work? I assume that there must be where maybe James doesn't like some of the storyline. So maybe he has an issue with some of the script or something, or a director does. How do you guys communicate on a timely basis, I guess?
Well, James never has an issue with the script. He loves everything we write. What we do is we have the room here. We're at Paramount, and we have our offices, and production is in New York, and they, you know, we have producer-director, Michael Watkins, who is sort of the captain there, and, you know, Laura Benson is the woman there who sort of runs the ship as far as keeping us on budget and keeping things moving and getting episodes done on time. And so we email back and forth. We talk daily. We have, you know, I'll get on and do a tone meeting with the director and with Michael, and we'll talk about in the fall cliffhanger, the crew in the woods there. It's like, okay, here's what we're looking for. We want it to feel like there's a singer, his name's Yellow Wolf. And I think I'm saying it right, Yellow Wolf. And I'm like sending them pictures and videos of this singer who's kind of this swamp guy with tattoos. And it's like, let's go for that look. And here's some music that might be a good inspiration for you guys. And, you know, we kind of talk through the way the episodes should feel. And also New York comes back to us and says, guys, you have Red going to visit his plastic surgeon at a beach club in Miami, which is fantastic, but it's February. So we should talk about that. And we say, well, what do you have? And they often find great locations, and we start writing to those locations. And, you know, a lot of our set pieces and stuff, they'll say, well, you know, you wrote a car hanging off a bridge. We can't do that. But we have this great under the bridge place where we think we could have the permits to blow this thing up. So could we try that? And so it's a very fluid sort of process where the episodes really aren't done until they're finished being shot, because we'll be rewriting stuff the day of. I mean, James called today saying this thing I'm doing isn't working and I'm going to drop this paragraph. And we're like, okay, well, let's adjust that, you know? So it's a very fluid process, but I can't imagine being there because there's so much work to do here and just getting the script that I feel like I'd be overcome with all the sort of notes of locations and wardrobe. And, you know, we really trust them, and New York really makes the scripts look better than they are. You know, they make us look good.
Trey, you had a music question.
I do, because we were talking about music and trying to get that influence. I mean, you've been curating that great Spotify list, and then I went ahead and made it an Apple Music list since I didn't have Spotify, so I've just been like kind of feverishly going along.
Nice.
So are you going through and still curating most of that, or do you have a team that's doing that now, and they're just kind of bringing stuff to you?
Yeah, it's really our music supervisor is a guy named John Bissell, who is fantastic, and he's constantly sending me stuff, and I am probably more involved in it than he or some would like. John's an incredible collaborator and will send, you know, there'll be a new artist who he says, you should check this person out. I just went and saw a woman named Andra Day last week, and he's like, there's this concert, you should go check her out. She's going to be great. And I'm like, oh my God, we got to put one of her songs in the show. So that's an example where he'll be introducing me to new artists. Another thing, I remember being in the first season searching for songs online, and just you kind of go down the rabbit hole of YouTube videos and music. And if you like Willie Nelson, you might like this song. And if you like Patsy Cline, and I remember finding the slowed down version of Jolene by Dolly Parton. We actually named the character Jolene. I was like, she was named something else. And I was like, Bissell, if you can clear this song, we got to use it. And I'm going to name her Jolene Parker because
I want to use that song in five episodes from now. And so he went out and it was weird because like somebody just played the song 25% slower than it was recorded. And it wasn't like an official licensing. And so he had to go to Dolly Parton's music people and say, is this okay? And they finally agreed. And it was a last minute thing. And so it's a real collaboration, but there are many, many nights where my guilty pleasure in the thing that probably gives me more gray hair and not enough sleep is, you know, watching a cut and feeling like, well, is that song great at the end? And then starting to try to sync up some YouTube song that I find or some song in my Spotify list with the picture that we have cut. But I just love doing that. That's one of the things that makes the show so fun. It comes together when you put the music in. It just elevates everything.
Yeah, it's probably the thing that makes The Blacklist the most interesting to watch is just knowing, like, especially the Eli Matchett this year, you get that coming through the cornfield. It was just like the perfect,
right?
Track, you know, just to
say. I'm glad you say that. That's because I'm not a huge country fan. And I mean, a huge country fan of like outlaw country and Johnny Cash or Willie Nelson, that kind of stuff. But, and I didn't know that artist, and they sent that, and I was like, this might be good. This is more of a country sort of, you know, in the cornfields kind of stuff. And there was another song that I thought was great, and I went with that one because I was like, well, maybe there's people who are into that sort of music, maybe that'll be a shout out, you know? And so I'm glad that worked. I ultimately do think it was a good tune. It worked, but thank you for saying so.
Yeah, well, he pays attention to it. Trust me. He loves,
that's great.
Yeah, he loves the music you pick. Loves it.
Just in general, the music on the show. That's great.
Yeah. Yep, 70 on iTunes, on my iTunes list already. So I'm cleaning out the garage and it's always on repeat. It's great stuff.
Well, you know what I did? I went to, what is it on, the midnight special, you know, like I'm the guy who it'll be like 12:30 at night and there's like the infomercial for the midnight special Time Warner 15 disc set.
Oh no, that's
and
dangerous.
Like you're watching, oh my God. And I'll just sit there and watch that and go, oh my God, that song and that, oh, and those people saying that. And so I tried to buy that, like to download it. And it was only the discs. Like I don't want to watch the shows. And so I went on Spotify and downloaded like the 250 songs or whatever, or didn't download, however Spotify works, and have all those. So I'll just be like walking around the lot here, clicking through these songs, and I'm like, all of a sudden it's like Eddie Rabbit, I Love a Rainy Night, and I'm like, okay, I'm like 4 years old sitting in the back of my parents' car listening to Eddie Rabbit going, how are we going to fit this into the show? This is weird. So you got to go to the midnight special. Check that out. You'll love it.
Love it.
Definitely. You know, people don't realize how expensive that is. It is thousands and thousands of dollars for every time you use a song. So I don't think they realize how selective you have to be to do that.
That is very difficult. We have a budget, a certain number that we have to hit for each episode. And I just saw episode 9 and episode 10 in the last week. And both of them have great, great music. And we had to go through and lift. The episode 9 had like five songs and we had to lose two of them. And episode 10 has both, and it will probably only have one, if any, there was Johnny Cash and James Brown, and they're both super hard clears and they're both very expensive. And, it'd be so great. It looks so good. I was like, oh my God, this is so great. But we'll see if we can clear them or afford them.
I think pretty much everybody is kind of on this board, especially this third season. So we come out with The Blacklist. Red says it's the names that he knows. And we go through season 1 where it was like leading up to who is Jolene Parker. And then it's who is Berlin. And then it's who is Berlin's daughter. And then it's what's the fulcrum. Mm-hmm. We get to season 3 and there's a couple episodes where Red doesn't know the guy or gal. Ariok Kane specifically comes to mind. Or does he? And I think that's something we have to keep in the back of my mind. Is he playing dumb or does he really not know? And whose list is this in season 3?
I just got off the phone before we started talking with Spader, who was so excited that he saw our 9th episode and was really excited about it. And the one that when we come back from our fall finale, mm-hmm. and he was very excited about this season, how we had broken the format in a way. And it was a scary thing to put our hero on the run and all of a sudden have the FBI agent not be an FBI agent. And one of the difficult things was we didn't want to become. One version was, one of the conversations was, how about we don't have a Blacklister of the week? How about we just start following these people? And that felt wrong, but we entertained it. And so the challenge was, how do we continue to bring a Blacklister of the week? And there were times in the first 8 episodes of the season where Red didn't know who ultimately the bad guy was, but knew that he was after something that would get him to that bad guy. For example, in that episode, Ariat Kane, which was the assassin. So the idea was that ultimately he took down Wendigo, the assassin, and yet he identified and he took down a website that was doing something horrible, and he found a girl who did something bad and got Liz off of it. I guess what I'm saying is, it to me, it feels like ultimately at the end of the day, if Red gives us a story and we are able to take down and remove a criminal who otherwise would be existing and operating had he not come forward, that fits the format to me. And, you know, we've shied away from and we're moving back into those where Red knows more about them. But look, he's finding his way as he goes through, and there are people operating out there in the world that he doesn't know about. And he, as much as it may seem, he is not omniscient and all-knowing. And so, yes, there were some of those episodes where he didn't know the end game, the ultimate end game for the bad guy. And we may have some more of those, but I don't know, just a way to try to mix it up, I guess, and try something a little bit different.
As you've done that this season, especially in terms of Liz, because you know her character has gone really dark in certain spots, I've debated this several times where I wonder, is the character Liz even, is she beyond the point of redemption? I know she's searching for it. Everybody's trying to help her achieve that, but is that really even possible? I assume you might not be able to answer that. I understand that because there's a season left.
Well, but I mean, look, that's an interesting question. I think that's one of the, I think she is definitely on a dark path. I think she is, and I think she will continue to be. I think that's what, look, that's what I think a lot of the show is about, is somebody who has her eyes opened. And look, whether he's her father or not, whatever their connection is, he is somebody who has become important to her and she is corrupted by. And, you know, it's sort of a battle for, it sounds cheesy, but it's a battle for her soul. It's a battle for, can she survive going through this process of, you know, can she survive? Really? That's it. And so I don't know. I do know, but I'm not going to tell you, but it's going to be fun. I'll tell you that.
All right. I'm excited. Amy Kelly wants to know, what real life geopolitical or international events have inspired your storylines? And are there any specific people who have inspired the characters in the show?
As far as real events that inspire stuff, I mean, you know, we subscribe to the Times and to Time Magazine, and we try to look at what's going on out there in the world. Most of the time, they're things that are more concepts rather than a real, well, one that comes to mind, I guess, is in our first episode this season, we had the troll farmer is a real thing. We found an article in the New York Times. It was about a Russian group. There's a house that has a bunch of young people who work in it, and what their job is to send out disinformation, and they do disinformation campaigns, and that felt like a really interesting blacklister. We did the front was one which was about an outbreak, a biological sort of contamination, and that just happened to be at the same time as the sort of Ebola, was it Ebola? It was happening last year. I remember huge outbreaks right when the episode was airing, and I thought, oh God, how horrible. But the timing almost makes it seem like we know what we're talking about when we have no idea. But mostly they're sort of hatched within the rooms.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the front, because Pepper has the key to the fulcrum in the wind chime.
She does.
And
yes,
and she's dead.
Hidden in the bottle.
Right. And now that she's dead, everybody's asking, like, can we clear up just how did Red and Pepper know each other? Or is that something that's yet to
well,
out there?
Well, you know what? That's, I mean, in my mind, a lot of these are things that do we go tell that story later or not? And maybe we will. We at least, I think, have the threshold in the room of, does this make sense? And I could easily, whether this is ultimately what it is or not, in my mind, her father was, she was a hippy-dippy off in the woods, you know, smoking whatever and sort of saving the planet, because her father was an incredibly conservative, sort of bullish politician who she had become estranged from, and he had ties to the cabal slash the fulcrum slash that world. So in my mind, I imagine her father as somebody who was incredibly politically savvy and yet disconnected from her. So she had perhaps stolen something from him that she knew was very important. And that is the thread of the connection there. So again, that's an example where that story could change. We might go back and revisit that. It may just be a key in a bottle.
Tessa, we do this thing on the podcast called Red's Rhetoric, where we kind of vote on what the best Red story of the week was.
And, oh, nice.
Yeah, and Tessa, she's fascinated with the craft of Red speak, as she calls it. She wants to know how hard it is to write that, that art of concealing things in plain view within his stories and explanations, and how hard is that to write those almost monologues?
They're the most fun part of the show, because they don't have any plot to them. They don't have any... You know, James will go vamp and do a great job. I don't know how he memorizes this stuff. I mean, he'll do a page speech, and you'll watch the dailies. He'll just go straight through. I mean, it's not like he's sitting there. I'd be reading a teleprompter, you know. But wow. They're incredibly fun to write. They're usually the writers all contribute in incredible ways. But oftentimes, John and I will be sitting here late at night. It happened last night, where we were here at about 11 o'clock and we had a story, and he was talking about something that will happen in episode 13. And he was talking about this family drama, and John said, oh my God, it sounds like a telenovela. And all of a sudden we just started giggling about it. And we're like, oh, a telenovela. And you go, I once saw a telenovela in Mexico City. I was captivated. And you just start going down this weird wormhole of meandering and yet making it relevant, hopefully, and poignant. And they're great fun. Those are so much fun to write. But just, again, thinking of Red being holed up in a hotel room for 48 hours because he was binge watching a telenovela. It's just a goofy image. And so usually we're trying to make ourselves laugh. So sometimes trying to be poignant.
Is the eye roll then from you or from Eisendrath that you actually then write as Megan's eye roll in the show?
That's Megan's eye roll. She's like, oh my God, I'm listening to you go on again. I can't stand it. So that is usually her contribution.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Can we submit, I've said on the show, I don't think Aram and Samar have an actual relationship. You guys were just funning with us. But people say that, yes, it was definitely stated. I say it wasn't stated. What's the correct answer?
Well, I'll tell you the correct answer. Why not? I think the correct answer is it's infatuation. I think nothing has happened yet.
I win.
He's clearly head over heels for her. She's fascinated by him. She's flattered. And he's a little bit of a puppy with her. But no, I don't think they've been sneaking around. I'll tell you where that came from is that is a storyline that really was born out of the actors and New York making us look good and finding a song that worked. At the end of that, I think it was the front, she was in the hospital and it was Amir and Samar playing a scene, and he was sitting with her, and we knew that he had sort of flirted with her a little bit. But the way he played it, and he was sitting there with her, and he took her hand, and the song was called You Were Born by Cloud Cult. And I've been driving around listening to this song forever. And when we heard that song to that, and I watched them, I was like, oh my God, I am so lucky the way these guys elevate this stuff. And you just felt something that was not on the page. You felt a deep sort of care that he had for her. So that was like, okay, we can't just ignore that. You know, that's one of those happy accidents that sort of, you're watching an episode come together, the actors sort of do something you weren't intending, it's there, and you go, wow, let's write to this. We weren't, especially in the first year, and then in the second year, a very soapy show. We've sort of embraced that in the third year, and we're now getting to know the other characters in ways that we hadn't before. The first Liz and Red, Liz and Red, and a little bit of Tom, and now it's kind of like, what about these other people? That's hopefully been fun for viewers to sort of unravel those stories, and that certainly is a case of that there. But I don't think anything's happened quite yet.
Yeah, and the internet was like a flood. It's like, did you see the picture of them on the refrigerator? Oh my goodness.
Well, that's right. That was specifically there because we knew in that episode or the next episode she was going to be sleeping with wrestlers. So you got to tee up the heartbreak.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well played, sir.
We all felt it.
Well, Thank you.
I didn't feel it because I'm like, nice guys always finish last. Your own fault.
Yeah, that's right.
So switching gears then, we have this one that came in from Anna. Are the similarities that we see, because wrestler's been hunting red his whole life, and we see this kind of, you know, wrestler trying to do good, but also kind of, you know, not doing good at the same time because he wants to find Liz. And so there's these similarities between Red and Wrestler. Are they intentional, or are we just kind of looking for something that isn't there?
No, I think there's, I mean, look, he's got Red's blood running through his veins. That was something that once that choice was made, it's like, well, there's something interesting to toy with. And, you know, like Wrestler is a guy who's conflicted. He's trying to be a Boy Scout. He's got some storylines that will be coming in the next few episodes that I think speak to that. And I think he's torn. He hates the guy. You know, he hates Reddington. He hates everything he stands for. And yet Reddington is probably right that the world is not as black and white as Wrestler wants to believe. So I think that's a very difficult headspace for Wrestler to be in.
Well, be careful, because anytime you say you use any words too loosely, people will start saying, well, maybe Red is Wrestler's dad. I don't, you know, there's
maybe Wrestler's Red's father.
Yeah.
I mean,
how would that work?
There might be a wormhole somewhere in time.
Mind blown.
That the orange box actually has a component that can take you to another dimension. I don't know.
The wormhole doesn't open until 2017. That's what Alan was
It doesn't. Not until 2017. That's when they figure out how to use it. Yeah.
That's so funny. Brandy S. She wants to know, in the world of instant gratification that we live in, where do you sit? Are you glad the show is week to week and gets to breathe, or would you rather it be all at once, like Netflix is? How do you address those fans that want answers now?
I honestly can't imagine it any other way. I mean, I would love to do something, you know, that's like a 12-13 episode Netflix, you know, sort of show. I think that would be fascinating. But I think we're incredibly blessed that we've got 122 episodes. I think it's very difficult to do, but it's also fun. We're making a movie every week. And so I embrace the situation we're in. I do think that had this show been on, you know, cable or HBO, or had been a True Detective type template, I think it'd be a very different show. I believe that one of the things that is hard, but that makes us paint within the lines, are the parameters of network television. There are words we can't say. There are things we can't show. And I think by virtue of that, it makes us tell a certain kind of story. I think if we were on an outlet where we could tell any story we wanted, it could probably end up being a super dark, horrible show that no one would want to watch. So I think by virtue of that, I embrace that. You know, I'd love to do something else too, but I think we're in a really good space because of that.
Is there stuff you wish you could? I realize network television, there are limitations. It's not like cable. Some people don't realize that sometimes.
Yeah.
Is there stuff that you can't do because standards and practices, you know, and you just can't do it on network TV?
Oh, my God. Constantly. Yeah. I mean, that's a weekly conversation.
Like, what's the craziest thing? Like, I wish we could have done that, but, you know, we're trying to be good for the kids.
Well, I'm not sure if it's going to happen or not. So, spoiler alert. But we have an episode that I'm super psyched about that involves wrapping children up in saran wrap, into sort of cocoons and hanging them from the ceiling.
I love it.
And suffocating them that way. And NBC, for whatever reason, thought that perhaps that was a bit too dark. And maybe for that reason, we won't do that. But when we're sitting here in the room and we start giggling, to me, it's not dark. I mean, I know that's terrible and horrible, but it's funny to me. These things are so weird. The Stewmaker or some of these bad guys, the giant in the woods, they're so weird that they make me laugh. And so, you know, when I'm sitting here with Dan Knopf, who's talking about, I bring Dan up and say, we're doing something that might involve fairy tales, and the person would be maybe killing these children. How would they do it? And we're talking about butterflies and sort of a metamorphosis. And he's like talking about saran wrap, and then the saran wrap goes around the head, and you poke out the hole in the mouth so the kid can still breathe. And I'm just like laughing, going, how is this a job? How am I sitting here able to do this? It's just so weird and so funny. Sometimes that really pisses off the network and the studio, and they oftentimes don't love the weird, dark creeps of the week. And oftentimes they're a great barometer. We have an episode coming up that has to do with religion that they are very sensitive about. They were very sensitive about the Djinn, where we were talking about certain sort of perspectives on homosexuality. And you know, but that's what's fun about it.
Yeah, the cross having to be the X rather than being the standard Christian cross, obviously. Standards.
By the way, that is exactly right. We could not show a standard traditional cross. It had to be an X, and an X was okay. And I'm like, even better. That's strange.
The Djinn was a bold episode, by the way. I just want to tell you that was a good. It was well played.
One of my favorites.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was really. Thank
well played. You. Thank you.
Who's your favorite? I mean, out of all, you've got, you know, few dozen now. Who's your favorite blacklister? I'm sure you got to have one.
You know, I'm the guy who likes the weird stuff. So I think Spader likes the bigger international sort of high stakes type characters and bad guys. I think Eisendrath probably leans into more of the deep character stuff and the complex characters. And I just like the weirdos in the woods, you know, and it's hard to, I mean, I referenced the Stewmaker already probably twice just because that was the first time in the show, in the series, where I was like, wow, we're actually able to do this. And I remember sort of thinking, what would we see? And the guy would probably not want to leave hair at the crime scene, so he'd probably shave his body, I guess. And then all of a sudden we're writing scenes where here's a man shaving his entire body, which, by the way, Tom Noonan did. He had like a foot-long beard before he came into the to shoot, and he shaved everything. I don't think he would shave his eyebrows because they said they wouldn't grow back. And so we had debates about that, but we were cool with that. And so I think the Stewmaker's fun. I love Milton Bobbitt having his mushroom shakes and taking off his nose and sitting there in his underwear in the chair. And so that's I get into that stuff. Thankfully, there's a balance here, and other writers on the show have other appetites.
There's a lot of good ones. And you get a lot of good guest stars, great guest stars, actually.
We have. We've had a lot of luck with that. We've been super fortunate. Yeah.
Any particular favorites or guys that you've tried to get that you're still having, or people that maybe you have that you can tease, or?
Sure. There's some that just haven't worked out because, I mean, look, I would love to have Dwight Yoakam on the show. I'd love to have Lyle Lovett on the show, or Stephen Wright, you know. I love Alan Alda. It broke my heart to kill him. And there was a version originally that, you know, we had written that he blows up in the box. And there was some concern that we don't want to lose him. And so ultimately that was written out. And we saw and he lived, and we saw the episode and decided it didn't work. We had to stick with what the story was. And as much as we love Alan Alda and as great as he is, he had to blow up. So sometimes they're hard decisions, but we've been super lucky with that. I didn't understand that was part of the, that goes with the territory, that you invent new characters, you need new actors, and whether they're well-known or not, you know, some of our best actors or characters, I think, have been sort of, you know, New York stage actors. I thought Richie Koster, who played Onslow Garrick, was fantastic, you know, yes. And nobody, he's not a movie star, you know, now I see him, I saw him in Creed, I saw him in True Detective, but he's not a household name. Just a great actor. So that is a joy to be able to do that week to week.
Some of the best actors are not name actors, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's probably right. Yeah.
So speaking of those great actors and kind of Red's network, Valerie and Jen were kind of wondering, especially with Nicole Phillips doing such a great job with the comic book in this first issue.
Yeah.
Sebastian comes into play in the comic book. You get that time period between 1990 and 1994 where Red was off the grid, and you get to see some of that for the first time in the comic. So are we going to get to explore some of the ways that maybe Red and Kaplan met, or Red and Glenn met, as the show progresses here into 3 and maybe even 4 seasons?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, we don't deal with it as much. Within the show, it's a very delicate subject, because there is a period of, you know, 5-6 years there that the show is built around, and it's we have to be judicious in how often we go there.
with the comic, and I talked to Nicole about this when she started sort of conceptualizing what it would be, it's still the show. It's a little bit of an alt universe of the show. You know, like I said, Nicole, wait, you're flashing back to this time period. That's like kind of off limits. And she's like, well, don't worry about that. I'm not going to reveal anything that you don't want to reveal yet within the show, but I do think there's stories there that we can tell. So, yeah, I mean, I would love to go see the Mr. Kaplan spinoff. You know, I'd love to see, I'd love to go out and, come on, Glenn and Dembe, like, moving in together as a sitcom? Come on. Classic. Like, that would be fantastic. So, yeah, I think we definitely want to explore. We're constantly doing that. We're talking about that right now with Mr. Kaplan, exploring sort of her past with Red and how they met. And so, yeah, we'll see.
Oh, so much good stuff. You haven't even tried the tea stuff and you've already tea stuff. It's
thank you.
Well, appreciate, much appreciated.
So I guess, yeah, tease away. What are we going to expect for the rest of season three as we,
Break? Well, the ninth and 10th episodes, I'm so excited about, When this is released or airs or whatever happens with a podcast, it's still before we come back. Is that right? Or when does this happen?
It'll be out within a week, probably a week and a half, something like
that.
Oh
my God. Well, the ninth and 10th episodes, I'm very excited about. There's great turns in, 11 and we just finished the script for 13 today. There's, what do I say without getting myself in trouble? There are toward the back half of the season, some really big turns that make me a little nervous in terms of the story and the structure of the show and what we do. And I think for a little bit, we're going to get back to a little bit of the sort of case of the week. We've missed that a little bit, and I think we've got some great stories that we want to tell about blacklisters that, you know, Red knows about that need to be taken out. We've got a great sort of doppelganger story coming up. We've got a like I mentioned, there's sort of a fairy tale blacklister, and I think storyline wise, we've got a lot of balls in the air in terms of where the characters are going, where Liz goes from now, how she handles what she's been dealt with. One thing, I'll be quite honest, I watched the season finale of the second season. I was so excited about Elton John, and I wanted to see it live, and I watched it. And when she went off with Red in the end, I didn't have a panic attack, but I kind of freaked out realizing that she had murdered the Attorney General.
And
that you don't, that's not like she was framed, you know? I mean, she was framed for stuff, but she also murdered somebody. And so those kinds of obstacles that we put in the middle of the show that sometimes are terrifying and we go, how are we going to write around or through or out of this? Those are the most exciting. And I think we've got something that is, I know we have something that is that much of a game changer in terms of where the show goes. How well we'll handle it, I have no idea. We could totally screw it up in the execution, but we've got good ideas. But yeah, I think the back half of the season is going to be different, yet sort of explosive in a very different way. And I think the audience is going to have a lot of fun seeing how the next run of episodes unfold. You know, Red has a plan. I've heard you guys talking about it. Like, what is his plan? It's very Red Reddington, you know. Only he could have it.
I got excited. I thought you were going to tell us.
Oh, no way. Come on. No. But it will be fun. I do promise that. And I'm very excited. I really am very excited about the sort of the groove that I feel like we're in now. You know, sometimes the stories come a little easier. Sometimes they're harder. And I think we've got a great story engine right now. And hopefully we'll ride that out.
And thanks again for paying things off so quick. I know you talked about it earlier, but sincerely, it's one of the things that I am most impressed about the show is that every cliffhanger, it's not like Lost, where there's so many threads and I never know if it's ever going to pay off. And you guys, for the most part, the little stuff. I mean, obviously not the big connection and ultimately, but the little stuff gets paid off the next episode, maybe two episodes down the road. I really appreciate that as a fan.
Well, I'm glad you like that. I can't tell if that's good or bad. I'm like, oh my God, maybe we should stretch it out. We should milk it more. But no, that's good. That's the kind of storytelling I like. I want answers, and I want it to keep turning and the machine to keep moving and push forward into the stories rather than have the audience sort of linger, you know, and wait. I do think that, you know, people who watch and the more closely they watch, I really am proud of how The Room and the staff here has kept the mythology straight, and ultimately, thus far, everything adds up to a really, I hope, satisfying end game, both within a run of episodes and ultimately the end game of the series. So it's very fortunate to be able to be doing it.
It makes it great for us that you guys wrap those up really quickly, too, because we do this profiling question of the week. So whenever we pick the one that's going to be the quickly wrapped up story, like Charlene and the Neighbor, it makes us look really good.
Okay, well, don't expect that to be wrapped up anytime too soon, because
there's more. Yeah,
I know. There might be a little more to that.
Well, I know we can't keep you much longer. I know you've got a lot of stories to write and probably to get home, honestly.
I know that I saw Dan's, when you had Dan Knopf on, I was like, an hour and a half. How the hell can the guy talk for that long? Dan, have some standards. And we've been talking for about an hour and a half. So I've got to get off before Dan did. So just for my dignity.
You're still a little ahead of him. You're doing all right. You still got plenty of time. I don't know what he went. He went about an hour and 40 almost or something.
Oh, good God.
Yeah. Has there been an official, and forgive me, I don't follow the numbers as because I just watch the show and I enjoy it. I don't check it every 15 seconds to make sure that the ratings are what everybody wanted. But it's one of NBC's most popular shows. Is there an official announcement yet for renewal? Are we still waiting?
No, we're not. We've been renewed for the fourth season.
That's what I thought. Okay. I just want to make sure.
We knew about that a while ago. It's one of those things that's hard to keep quiet. But yes, we're renewed through the fourth season. Hopefully we don't tank that out. We got a lot of story to tell. But yeah, we are renewed through the fourth season.
And I had, in closing, a lot of fans that listen to the show and especially wanted to say thank you to you and the cast simply because it's honestly one of the most fan-responsive, especially communities on Twitter and whatnot, when the show airs and you see almost all the actors are present.
And they love it. Yeah.
And they're tweeting back to fans. And there aren't many other shows that do that. So that's really a testament to how much you guys respect the community.
Yeah. Look, as having an opportunity through you guys to say that to the fans, I got to say, it is a sheer joy to be able to do it. You know, we come in here and I am here far too late, far too many nights of the week. And so many of the writers and the, you know, the people who work in New York and the crew, and it is a grind. It is very difficult to do this many episodes, and we are trying our best. And to be able to know that fans are interacting with the show and engaging with it, and sometimes we hit a bullseye, sometimes we're way off, but it really is satisfying because I've spent a lot of time being the unemployed writer who's sitting in the room and writing scripts that either no one will read or that are sitting on a shelf, and I thought those were great, and nobody was able to see them, and I work on these, and I'm very proud of them, and it's a real joy to have people be able to see them and interact with them and enjoy them. So, and I appreciate you guys helping perpetuate that and doing the podcast. So thank you.
Groovy. All right. Thanks, guys.
All right.
Thanks, and have a good night.
Have a good night.
Take care. Troy, that interview was awesome.
That was fantastic. And we got it less than Daniel Knopf, so that means we still have some street cred with John.
A little bit. I do want to say a lot of great questions came in from a lot of people, partners of the show even. And because of a lot of the stuff was answered throughout the actual interview, some of those questions weren't answered. A lot of those questions actually weren't asked because they were already answered or because we didn't have time to fit them in. So I hope we do appreciate everybody that sent in questions. Obviously, we couldn't read them all. We tried to pick the most relatable to everyone as possible. And I think we covered most bases, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, looking at the list of questions that we had in, I think a lot of them were answered as he was kind of describing certain things and going from topic to topic. So even though we didn't say your name, we absolutely got them and made sure they were answered. So I think you'll be pleasantly surprised as to how much information was just in there. I want to actually touch on one of these, actually, myself, Aaron, that we were kind of listening as he was going along. He was talking about Wrestler and Red, which was a great question coming in from the fan community. And he meant, he said specifically the line, Red's blood running through his veins.
Oh, my God. Can we not just pick apart the poor man? He just got done talking.
Let we wouldn't be doing our job, though, if it, you know, fans are like hearing that, too. And they're like, what does that mean? Oh, my goodness. Like, I picked up on that right away. So, of course, then you went and said, you were bold. You were just like, does that mean, like, Red is Wrestler's dad?
Hey, I know how everybody thinks, and that's exactly what everybody starts thinking. Wait, what did he mean? So it's better just to ask and get it out there. It's better just to ask and get it out there.
That was fun. There's a wormhole in the box in 2017.
I like that. Wrestler could be Red's dad. That would be fantastic, and everybody else would hate it. I would love it. Go for it. Oh,
so good. So
make
good.
It's better than the mom theory, in my opinion.
It totally is.
Well, I guess I should ask you, what did you gain from the interview? What's the one thing, the biggest thing you gained from the interview?
I think the biggest thing I gained is just how diverse the writing staff is when he was talking about which blacklisters are his favorite, which ones are John Eisendrath's favorite, you know, which ones are Daniel's favorite. It's really great to see that everybody has such care for these characters, even that high up, right? I mean, you're thinking about, oh, I've got to run this show, and I got to make sure my scripts are on time, and I got to make sure all of this stuff happens. But at the core, they're still really concerned about, I want this song to hit this beat on this bar with this facial look from this expression. I think that's just fantastic that it's got so much care and detail to it that you just don't really appreciate, I think, as a fan until you get to hear that these guys really do care about the show, and they're not going to make sure that we're pissed off at the end because it just wrote a crappy ending because the network canceled them or something. These guys really do care, and I love the fact that he's talking about this fan website and, you know, really trying to showcase all of us.
No, absolutely, and that's the number one thing I got. Now, I already know just from years of doing Hollywood Outsider, I know how the inside works and how much work it is, and television is much more work than I think a lot of people realize. But what I got from this show is they genuinely care about the fan community. There are a lot of shows that do not, or do not put the effort into it. They just let it naturally take care of itself, so to speak. You know, and you won't see the actors on Twitter. You won't see them doing fan events. You won't see them doing podcasts like this. You just flat out will not see it. It's right, you know this. I mean, Golden Spiral Media has a lot of shows, and a lot of those shows will never get people from those shows on just because they don't see a point to it. They really respect you guys, the fans, and you guys listening are some of the most devoted fans out there, obviously. And the amount of time that they put into letting you know that they appreciate you, I think is something that, whether I'm a fan of the Blacklist or not, I think is something you should be very proud of, because most people in entertainment that I have come across are not as involved as they are.
And well, this would be a perfect time then, I suppose, to say how much they still appreciate us, because next week we're going to be back again, another special holiday episode, and we're going to have Aram himself, yes, Mr. Amir Arison's going to be here on the show. He's our special cast member. Are you excited to find out? Is he still brooding over the loss of Samar? Is he riding his bike feverishly just to burn off the energy because he's pissed off for getting her fired? Yeah, it's going to be some really great questions we're going to have coming up next week.
I'm going to fight him for her. Let's be honest. That's really what it's going to boil down to. I am going to fight you for her. We're going to arm wrestle. I mean, nothing brutal, because I'm not that brutal, but we'll arm wrestle or something. It's important.
No, it's going to be so good. Just can't wait. Can't wait. But before we get out of here, we do have to pick that winner of our contest.
Why don't you pick that winner?
All right, here we go. I'm going to shuffle up the things in the hat here. And the winner of the Season 1 and Season 2 copies of The Blacklist is Bailey103 from the USA. Bailey103, that's your iTunes handle. And I know that's a bit cryptic. So Bailey103 from the USA, the real Bailey103, please stand up and send us your information. You can email us at theblacklist@goldenspiralmedia.com. That's theblacklist@goldenspiralmedia.com. And that way we can make sure we get your copies out to you. So just go ahead and send us your information, and we'll be sure to get that out your way.
Yeah, don't be shady. We can track it, so we'll know if it's not you, sir or ma'am.
That's right. And if we don't hear from you, we'll give you about a month, okay? So we'll wait till the show comes back,
And if we haven't heard from you in a month, we will pick a new winner on our, was that January 9th-ish episode, somewhere's in there. Mm-hmm. So got 30 days to let us know who you are, Bailey 103.
All right, I think it's going to do it. I know this episode has gone on very long, but I think it's been great. I hope everybody got a ton of information. You can go ahead and go crazy dissecting it to your heart's content until our next interview next week, which is really exciting. That's really good stuff. Thanks to Troy for putting this all together, by the way. Troy's been doing a lot of work. Good job, Troy.
It's all for you guys. Seriously. John reached out to us, so I think that's really a testament to say, you know, how much you guys are listening to the show, watching the show. It's really great that John's recognizing that, and so just keep your answers coming. That's the best part. The fan feedback section is what he loves. So make sure you answer the profiling question. Make sure you call in your theories, because they're looking for them, and they'll write off of them. They said so.
Yep, absolutely. You never know. You never know.
Remember, you can also subscribe to the podcast in iTunes and leave us a review, so make sure you go ahead and do that so you don't miss next week's interview with Aram, and then Amir, whichever way you want to go with it. And then, of course, the week after that, we still have that comic book finale episode and preview of Series 2 with Nicole Phillips. So subscribe, 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 so you do not miss these special episodes, because there is no TV show.
So much blacklisting going on. Well, that's going to conclude this episode of The Blacklist Exposed. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at TheBlacklistGSM. We live tweet during the East Coast feed, and we will use the show's hashtag, The Blacklist. We also have a Facebook group. Just search for The Blacklist Exposed and join us for the fun.
Intel from you is what we want, and we have a few ways you can do that. Submit it in to the agency right here via that feedback form on the Golden Spiral Media website, or just hit us up on Twitter or Facebook, just like Aaron mentioned.
Hmm. You can also subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, leave us a review, like Troy mentioned, or listen from the website. But if you're really on the go, like Red and Liz, make sure you download our app for iOS and Android, powered by Spreaker. You will also find all the intel and analysis about our discussion with John Bokenkamp by visiting theblacklistexposed.com. Big thanks for listening.
We'll see you next week. Until next time, I'm Agent Troy Heinrichs. That's at Troy Heinrichs on Twitter. And if you want to learn more about me, just visit, well, about.me/Troy Heinrichs.
And I'm Agent Aaron Peterson. You can hear me talking about movies and TV on the Hollywood Outsider podcast, as well as Remake This Movie Right. We are available at thehollywoodoutsider.com or on Twitter at @H_Outsider. Be sure to subscribe, download the app, submit your feedback, but most importantly, keep yourself off of
the blacklist.
The Blacklist Exposed is a Golden Spiral Media production, copyright 2015. Find more of our great podcasts at goldenspiralmedia.com/podcasts.